Are you welcome? So this is a very short trip, I understand.
Yeah.
England is close enough that you can make short trips. America is a little more difficult. But again, I hope that your time has already been good, and I hope it'll continue to be very good. And you come back often. Come back often. This is, you know, it's interesting that they tell the story about a Hasidic Rebbe whose family was in Poland for 500 years. And they would ask the Rebbe, "Where do you live?" He would say, "I live in Yerushalayim, but temporarily my family has relocated." So even though it's hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, this is your home. So anyway, I wanted to talk about the fact that we just had the holiday of Purim. Were you in Israel for Purim? Or?
No.
Okay. And we're now preparing for Pesach. In fact, the halacha basically is that you have to start learning about Pesach 30 days before Pesach. I mean, you're actually supposed to begin studying the laws of Pesach on Purim itself. Now, with all the drinking and the partying, it's a little hard to concentrate on any halacha, but halachas of Pesach you're already supposed to be thinking about. So I wanted to share with you something about the Passover Seder. And the Passover Seder, the Pesach Seder, is one of those commandments that even people that are very, very far from Judaism, the two rituals, maybe there are four rituals that almost all Jews do, even if they're very, very far. Most will circumcise their sons, although some sometimes not today. The second is the Passover Seder. The third might be the Yom Kippur fast. And maybe the fourth might be lighting Hanukkah candles. Those are, I think, the most popular rituals that people keep. So the Pesach Seder is up there. Now, the Seder may not be kosher. It may not have kosher food, but they'll have matzah with the non-kosher meat and whatever it is, and they won't read the whole Haggadah, but they'll do something. Because there's something in us that resonates very much to the idea of remembering the Exodus of Egypt. And in fact, there's a passage in the Haggadah that says, each person must regard himself or herself as if they themselves were taken out of Egypt. Which is an amazing thought. You're not just commemorating or remembering what happened to our forefathers, but you actually have to experience the journey from slavery to freedom. You have to internalize it. You have to understand it. Thank you very much. You have to literally feel as if it is happening to you. And if you had to pick the topic sentence of the Haggadah, like what is the single most important idea in the Haggadah, that would be it. To feel as if you yourself are coming out of Egypt. Now the question is though, let's be real, the question is, what does that mean? I mean, after all, I was not in Egypt, I was not a slave. Yeah, I can be grateful for what God did to our forefathers, because if they wouldn't have been freed, the Jewish people would have assimilated and they would have been gone and I wouldn't be here. But that's simply saying I'm grateful for my forefathers being liberated. That's not the same idea as saying I myself was a slave in Egypt. Now, you know, I remember for years already, there's a travel agency near here, and when I'm on a bus and I see the window, I see an advertisement for trips to Egypt. You can take trips to Egypt, and I even saw an advertisement, spends Passover in Egypt. Mm. Pretty amazing, kind of a reverse. Crazy. Unless on the seventh day they go to the Red Sea or something. you know, it's kind of the wrong direction. But still, you know, I've never been in Egypt. Probably none of you have been in Egypt. So what does it mean? Oh, you've been in Egypt? Okay,
yeah.
Okay. But you weren't a slave in Egypt.
Oh, we're not scared to Egypt.
Huh? You are allowed. Oh, halachically? Well, it's interesting. The Torah does say you're not allowed to return to Egypt. That's very true. But that only applied vis-a-vis the ancient Egyptian nation. It's not so much the land, it's the people. And the modern Egyptians are Arabic people. They're not those people. That's why Maimonides, the Rambam, lived in Egypt.
Yeah.
You know?
Alexandria.
That's right. Well, no, the Rambam lived in Cairo. Alexandria had a huge Jewish community. A lot of them were secular, but the Rambam lived in Cairo, Fustat, which is the old Jewish neighborhood of Cairo. And even Rav Avadya Yosef, have you heard of him?
Yeah.
He just died a short while ago.
Yeah.
When he was young, his first rabbinical position was in Egypt, although he was born in Yerushalayim, he went to Egypt for two years and the like. In fact, one of the most famous sources of old Jewish books is the very famous Cairo Geniza. Perhaps you heard of it. It's been moved to Cambridge University. The Geniza is where people put, you know, books and letters that are holy that are no longer usable. And they were keeping stuff there like for 1,000 years. You know, just a big attic. And this has a huge, huge, huge amount of material that's still being mined to figure out what Jews were writing 1,000 years ago.
Is that where they found the child's exercise book for writing the Aleph-Bet?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. This is the, as they say, they're still getting stuff out of it, more than 100 years since it was opened up. But most of the collection is in Cambridge University, and it's really like a jigsaw puzzle because the papers have all, you know, decomposed, and people spend the whole day like trying to match up. You know, this. Imagine if you had a whole book that was ripped up into a million pieces, and you're trying to match together the pages and everything. Yeah, that's what they've been doing it for 100 years now. But but now they have the technology. Now they can really accelerate it much faster than it was before computers. Some person had to sit 12 hours a day or with 14 hours a day with little pieces of paper and trying to match them and the like. Now you can kind of do it very, very quickly. So the question then becomes, okay, so, you know, we weren't slaves. So what does it mean each person must regard themselves as if they were slaves in Egypt? So let me offer you two interpretations. The first is that of the Rambam, Maimonides, who, of course, actually lived in Egypt. And Maimonides looks at this as a sort of, to use a modern term, method acting. If you're familiar with Lee Strasberg method acting, this is the concept where in order to really enact a role or act a role, you have to emotionally put yourself in the moment. So if you're portraying, let's say, a homicidal maniac, you have to make yourself crazy. In fact, sometimes they say, occasionally they say people commit suicide. There are actors who have committed suicide. Some people attribute it. You know, there was an actor, Heath Ledger, and he played the Joker in a Batman. And apparently, I didn't see the movie, but apparently the Joker was so psychotic that Heath Ledger became psychotic, and he had to, and I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but you know, that kind of resulted in his own suicide. So method acting is the idea that to truly experience the moment, you have to train your emotions to feel everything that character would feel. So the Rambam says that the Passover Seder in an optimal way, now not that we always get there, is really an exercise in method acting. In other words, in order to be grateful to God for liberating our forefathers from slavery, you have to feel what it's like to have been a slave. And you have to imagine being beaten and whipped and carrying bricks and having your children torn away from you and thrown into the Nile and murdered. And by imagining, using the power of imagination, you can truly feel grateful to God because you're experiencing the pain of slavery and then you experience the joy and jubilation of liberation. Now, to put it bluntly, therefore, according to Maimonides, it is not a reality that each of us was in Egypt. Rather, it's an imaginary state that we need to almost self-hypnotize ourselves into in order to properly appreciate what God has done for us. Okay. But I want to share, so that's one understanding of it. And again, I'm not saying that's illegitimate. Maimonides said it. Obviously, there's a great deal of power to that. But I want to share with you a Hasidic thought. And this is, appears in a lot of sources. It appears in the Tanya of Rav Shneur Zalman, called the Alter Rebbe, the first Rebbe of Chabad. And later, the Sfas Emes, the Gera Rebbes, and Rav Sodom. And they say the following. Yeah, thank you. They say that the word Mitzrayim, has a double meaning. Mitzrayim is Egypt. It does refer to a nation. But Mitzrayim also is etymologically connected to the word for blockages, confinements, narrow straits, as it says in Psalms, in Tehillim. We say it in the Hallel. When King David turns to God and says to God, I'm desperate, I need your help. So David HaMelech says, Min HaMeitzar, Meitzar is the singular, Min HaMeitzar Karasi Ka. I call out to you, God, from the narrow, confining places. So Mitzrayim is both a nation and a historical reality, but it also refers to the inner blockages that each and every one of us has in serving God. Each and every one of us has our own Mitzrayim. We could be prisoners of arrogance. We could be prisoners of depression, of selfishness, of egotism, of anger, of hedonism, of laziness. That is our Mitzrayim. And you know, to paraphrase an old cigarette commercial that they used to play when I was growing up, you've probably never seen a cigarette commercial on television. It used to be a cigarette Salem. You could take Salem out of the country, but you can't take the country out of Salem. So similarly, it's easier to take the Jew out of Mitzrayim than it is to take Mitzrayim out of the Jew.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why are we so in Mitzrayim ourselves?
Well, this is the nature of the Yetzer Hara that's internal within us, meaning this world is a world of struggle. God concealed himself in this world. In fact, the Baal HaTanya writes that the very word for olam, is the same shorish as ha'elam, which is concealment. God is concealed. It's our job to discover him. It is our job to uncover him. And as a result, we have all sorts of negative forces. Now, people always ask the question, are humans basically good or basically bad? And the truth of the matter is, our divine souls are holy and are good. We are basically good. There is goodness within us. We are made in the image of God. An image does not mean physicality, because God does not have a physical image. But image refers to the moral qualities of goodness, of intelligence, of free will, autonomy, that we're not people that are forced to act out of instinct. We act out of choice, which itself is a divine attribute, although we can abuse it. But we have these negative forces within us that can pull us down, whether it's arrogance, ego, hedonism, desire for comfort. And God made it that way because, you see, virtue is good only when it's chosen, not when it's automatic. If we would be automatically good, then we would not be virtuous.
Like Andrews.
That's right. We would be like robots, like a computer, a car. Yeah. Huh? That's right. Goodness requires the capacity to be non-good, and even the desire to be non-good, and you then, you know, evil,
choose.
And you then choose, and then your goodness is a goodness. In many, many ways, evil, the capacity of man for evil, is a necessary evil. It's necessary for good, because without my capacity to do evil, and without my desire to sometimes do evil, on a large or even a small scale, my choosing to do good would be a meaningless choice. And let's imagine the other way. You know, people say, how come bad things happen to good people? Well, okay, let's imagine a world that worked the other way. Let's imagine every time you did something good, you got $1 million. Every time you did something bad, you got an electric shock that would go up for repeat offenses. Well, everybody would be good.
Yeah.
But they would be good the same way a pigeon is good when it has a Skinner's box. You know, Skinner's box, it has two levers.
Yeah.
If it pushes one lever, it gets a shock or something. It pushes another lever, it gets a piece of corn. Birds are not smart. Pigeons are not particularly intelligent. Pigeons are far less intelligent than bears or dogs. But even a dumb pigeon is going to push the lever that gets it to corn. So if God made a world where good guys always come out on top, then even dumb people and even bad people are going to be good. But what value would that have? Now, it might make the world a smoother place, although kind of boring, but it wouldn't be a virtuous place.
There'd be no value in the good, would there?
Say again?
There'd be no value in the good.
That's what I'm saying.
There wouldn't
be
choosing it.
It would not be good. It would not be virtuous. And therefore, in many, many ways, a lot of the dysfunctionality that we see in the world is kind of a necessary infrastructure so that goodness would actually be chosen.
So when Mashiach comes,
yeah,
and everyone knows what's Yeah. We all know that.
You know, it is a very, very, it's a very, very excellent question. And that is, you know, we often describe Mashiach as there will not be the Yetzer Hara. Everybody will choose, you know, the good. The question is, why is that a good thing? It seems to be, from everything we're explaining, goodness is better when you have the Yetzer Hara, because then you're choosing good, and you're good because you want to be good, as opposed to things being automatic. You know, that's a very, very good, very, very good question. In fact, there's even a Maamar Chazal that describes the days of Mashiach as the days that you don't really want, because true goodness is when you struggle. But one way of looking at it is that, you know, struggle can exist on multiple levels. In this world, we struggle between the good and the bad. In Mashiach, we will struggle between the good and the better, meaning to say there are going to be multiple levels. I mean, you see this even in this world. For example, the drug addict, or the Baal Shuva that was a drug addict, might be struggling between taking heroin and not taking heroin. Now, for those of us that, Baruch Hashem, don't have that particular addiction, we're not struggling. Our struggle is on a different level. So there will be a Yetzer Hara even when Mashiach comes, but it won't be in the gross form that it is. It'll be in a more refined form. But there'll always be that struggle. So this is the idea of Mitzrayim. Right? Mitzrayim means each person has his own Mitzrayim. You know, there's an American entertainer, I think he's still alive, Mr. T. He's a black rapper. And Mr. T, big tough guy. And his thing is, he always wears these gold chains. So he once said a real good word. I like this word. Now, maybe he didn't intend all the depth I'm going to attribute to it. But somebody asked him why he wears gold chains. So he said, I'm emulating my ancestors who came to the United States as slaves from Africa. They wore chains and I wear chains. The difference is, their chains were iron around their legs and my chains are gold around the neck. But really, I'm imitating them. Now, this is actually profound, because what he's saying is, there's different types of slaveries. There's the slavery of the guy who wears the leg irons in which somebody is beating him. But then there's the slavery of Hollywood materialism, the rat race, hedonism. And that's a form of slavery too. Maybe that's a worse slavery, because that's an internal slavery. You know, you could be free. You know, they tell the story in the Nazi concentration camps that a Nazi was beating a Jew. And the Nazi said to the Jew, he says, what do you think of your religion now? You see what your religion is getting you, you know, you're beating. And the person said, all I can think now is I can make the bracha that God did not make me a guy.
Wow.
With much more kavana.
Wow.
Much more intention. He says, how can that be? Look where I am, look where you are. He says, yeah, that's exactly right. He says, I'm a person that's still a human being, that still has a soul, that still is connected to God. You're a person that destroyed everything. He says, I'm much more fortunate than you are. That's what he said. Because, you know, you could be beaten by a Nazi and you still have that inner freedom. And you can be the Nazi that's the king of the world and you're a slave to that Mitzrayim within you, that evil within you that you can't break away from. So based on this, the Sfas Emes says the following. You know, there's a concept in what is called sacred time, you know, Shabbos, Yom Tov, all of the holidays, that they are not just commemorations, but it's like a spiral or like a circle, that there are spiritual vibes in the air that bring those same emanations. Pesach, if Pesach is a Zman of redemption, it's not only because we were redeemed, but every single year, when that time comes around, we can become liberated from our own inner Mitzrayim. Each person must regard themselves as if they are personally being liberated from their Mitzrayim. So it's not like the Rambam who simply says, it's making believe you were a slave in Egypt. But it involves a deeper idea of recognizing your own Mitzrayim and recognizing that you can tap into the redemptive potentials of Pesach and become liberated from the Mitzrayim that enslaves you. In fact, this is actually an explanation of something in our calendar that we experienced this year. You know that the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar as opposed to a solar calendar, right? A solar calendar, the number of days that it takes the Earth to go around the Sun, we'll work with approximations. There's approximately 365 and a fourth days. A lunar year, which is 12 lunar revolutions around the Earth, is around usually 354 days. Right, so there's 11, right, so that's why the lunar year is normally 11 days shorter than the solar year. Now because of that, a Hebrew date is going to get progressively earlier and earlier vis-a-vis the secular calendar. So for example, if year one, Pesach was April 15, in the next year it's going to be April 4. And the year before that, it'll be, you know, March 25, whatever it would be. Right? Now that's if you had a pure lunar calendar. But the Torah says we have a little problem. Even though Judaism is based on a lunar calendar, we want to celebrate Pesach. The Torah says not we want to, the Torah requires that Pesach be celebrated in the spring. So when the Hebrew date would be too earlier in the year that you're approaching, locating it in the winter, so we have to add an extra month. That's the second Adar, to push the Hebrew date later into the year, and that is for the purpose of keeping Pesach in the springtime. And the way the calendar works, it's a very intricate calendar, 7 out of 19 years are halachic leap years. So we have operate with a 19-year cycle, and 7 out of the 19 will be leap years. This is one of the leap years. This is Adar. That's why we're still in the month right now of Adar Sheni. It's an interesting question. Which is the added month? We have two Adars. Normally you have one Adar, then you have Nisan. Okay? Is the extra Adar the first one, or is the extra Adar the second one? Okay, that's the machlokas, how you characterize it. But here is the question. By the way, the Islamic calendar is a pure lunar calendar without a solar adjustment. Or there's the word intercalation. There's no intercalation in the Islamic calendar, which is why the fast of Ramadan, which is a month long, is a moving fast. It could be any time of year. Actually, that's to their benefit, because although it's supposed to be in the summer, a summer Ramadan is very, very difficult. It's hot and it's long, so by making it a rolling holiday without a solar intercalation, Ramadan will sometimes be in the winter, where it's nice and short. Okay. Now, the question becomes this, though. The question becomes, why does the Torah want Pesach to be in the spring? Why is that even important? I mean, after all, we're commemorating historical events. Historical events are dated by the Jewish calendar. The Jewish calendar is 15th of Nisan, so whenever the 15th of Nisan is when we have Pesach. Why am I concerned whether it's winter, spring, fall, summer? What's the nafkamina?
Isn't that something to do about Sukkot being 6 months after Pesach and that has to fall in?
Yes, that's equally true. Meaning there are two reasons for the adjustment. One is the Chodesh Aviv of Pesach, that Pesach has to be in the spring. And the other is that Sukkot has to be in the fall.
So, and that's because you need to experience the cold sitting in Sukkot as a kid to be.
Right. So both are true. But still, the question still becomes, why do we care?
I would ask the other way around.
Huh? Yeah. Right. So the Maharal of Prague says a very beautiful point. He says like this. He says that what goes on in the physical earth, the physical phenomena of seasons, are reflective of spiritual powers. The earth itself is responding to spiritual power. What is the spring? Spring is the time of rejuvenation, of growth, of redemption of the ground from the dormancy of the winter. In the winter, things do not perceptibly grow. And in the spring, it's as if there is the liberation of these forces. But the reason that happens is because the spiritual power of redemption is in the air. So when Pesach is not in sync with the seasons, you might be commemorating the historical event, but it doesn't correspond to the spiritual forces that are in the air. And if we understand that Pesach is not just commemorating historical events, but it's re-experiencing the liberation from enslavement, then it has to correspond. It has to be in sync with what is going on in the earth. And now you may ask a question, well, wait a second here. In the southern hemisphere, South Africa, Australia, Pesach is not in the spring, right? So how does that work? No, but the answer basically is that spiritual powers enter the world from Eretz Yisrael and then they spread. So when it's spring here, it's the time of liberation, even if there's snow on the ground. It'll come, right? Everything comes from here and it spreads out. You know, in the days before cell phones, if you ever went, I'm sure you obviously have the train stations in London too, but I am familiar with the New York. If you ever went to Penn Station, the big train stations in New York, you would see all of the payphones, telephone booths, with Jews who were davening mincha in the afternoon. Like you're often stuck in the afternoon, you got to daven. So shachris, mincha is always the big problem. Shachris you could daven before you go to work, usually. Sometimes the winter is a problem even for shachris. Maariv you could daven when you come back. But mincha, people are often stuck. So here in Israel, if you're stuck, not a big problem. You can daven mincha in the street if you have to. You know, people are used to it. No big problem. But, you know, in most places, you know, you're looking for privacy or whatever it is. So what people used to do is they used to go to phone booths and take the receiver off and put it to their ear. And they would be having a conversation with God. They would be speaking the words of davening, right? So we used to say, ah, that's too bad. When you're davening in New York, you're paying long distance charges. If you do it on a phone here, it's going to be a local call. You know, that's kind of the difference. But okay, today with cell phones, it's hard to find. They don't have too many. I guess does London still have the those very pretty red phone booths? They're still there. Right, I know. Well, I know that England is very reluctant to change traditions. I know they keep a lot of traditions around. But okay. Anyway, so that's the thing. So the thing is that the spiritual powers enter the world through Eretz Yisrael. So this is the amazing thing. So when you're learning and you're experiencing your Pesach Seder, there are two stories that are going on simultaneously. Two different narratives. One is the national collective story of the Jewish people. What are our roots, our history? What made us a nation? The fact that we went through slavery and we suffered and God redeemed us and God kept his promise to our forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And he gave us a Torah. And this is the great shared history of Am Yisrael that the Torah commands a parent tell his child. And this is such a deeply rooted commandment that even people who are very far from Judaism, in one way or the other, feel a need to communicate this story. But I'll call that the national collective narrative. But in addition to the national collective narrative, which of course is the basic story, there's a profound private idiosyncratic narrative going on. And that is, you identify within your own personality the Mitzrayims that you have. And you recognize that this is the time in which God allows us to be liberated from that which enslaves us. It's like, maybe parasitic is a negative word I'm not to use, but in a sense, you become like a parasite, meaning it's parasitic. You can live off the redemptive power of Yetziat Mitzrayim to leave your own Mitzrayim. And therefore, every ceremony of the Seder has a double meaning. It is expressive of the collective story and it pertains to the individual. So now I'm going to give you a few examples. You know, Rabban Gamliel says in the Haggadah that anyone that doesn't explain three basic symbols of Pesach has not fulfilled his obligation. Do you remember that, Nagada? That this is really from the Mishnah, that Rabbi Gamliel says that even if you told over the whole story of the plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea, if you didn't connect it to these three ideas, you didn't do the mitzvah. And the three ideas are the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, the eating of the matzah, and the eating of the bitter herbs. So now what I want to show you briefly is how they connect to our own quest for personal liberation. Let's first take the idea of Maror. Right? The Torah commands us, on the night that we celebrate freedom, the Torah commands us to eat bitter herbs, whether it's horseradish or romaine lettuce, which is not so bitter, but it has a little bit of a bitter taste and the like. Now, why is it so important to remember slavery on the night of our freedom? So there are two ideas here. One idea might simply be, once again, it's a lesson in gratitude. Unless you remember how bad things were, you don't appreciate goodness. For example, people who were born in free societies do not appreciate freedom as much as those who came from persecuted societies. That's why, for example, people who are Holocaust survivors or people who came from the Soviet Union, they have a much greater love for democratic societies than people who were born here. You're born here, born in America, born in England, whatever it is, you just take things for granted. Because you were always born with those freedoms. You never knew another way of life. Even with health. People who are healthy, we sometimes take health for granted. If, God forbid, somebody is sick, seriously ill, and they recover, they cherish their health in a much, much greater degree. So in many, many ways, eating the bitter herbs is a symbolic way of remembering slavery, so we appreciate redemption. And that's legitimate. But there's another way of looking at it as well. That is, the first step to being spiritually liberated is to recognize you have slavery in you. To recognize your Mitzrayim. Because far too often, we kind of sleepwalk. Far too often, we don't even admit to ourselves that there are things I need to correct. There are things I need to improve. We don't want to think about it. It's too painful. So you see, it's a paradox. Knowing you are a slave is the first step to being able to be free. Acknowledging your Mitzrayim. Not denying it, acknowledging it. You know, for many years, my wife and I have only been in Israel, as Olim, only for 6 years. We're approaching our sixth anniversary. So for many, many years, I was born in America, and of course I lived in America, and I was a professor of law at the University of Maryland. So I would have to drive from the Washington, D.C. area to Baltimore, which, if you know the United States, that is going south. Oh, I'm sorry, it's going north. You're going north. So you're on a big highway called 95 North. Okay, so I'm driving a 95 North. But if you're not following, there's a turnoff as you're driving to the right, on the right lane, which is, you know, the way we drive in America, and that takes you 95 South, which gets you into Virginia and the like. And apparently I was once not thinking very carefully. I was like daydreaming or thinking about something else. And all of a sudden I'm driving on 95 and I start seeing the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, the very famous monuments. The only problem is you don't see them on the way to Baltimore. You only see them Virginia going south. So I realized, ay, 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 I'm going 95 south. But I was tired. I didn't really know the way correctly. So I just thought to myself, I can't even explain this, but maybe you've experienced it. You know, maybe I'm not really lost. Maybe these things are on the way to Baltimore. I just never saw them before. I said, you know?
You're on the train.
Yeah, I just never noticed it before. But okay. But I knew that wasn't true. But I didn't want to make the decision. Then I said, well, you know, maybe the road changes somehow. Now it does. If I go all the way to Florida, I could just turn around. You know. But what is this? Now again, rationally, none of this made any sense. But emotionally, we're very, very reluctant to change course. It's like even in a business deal. A person invests money, 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 money in a real rotten business. And at some point, the only sane thing to do is even if you're going to lose money, just cut your losses and get out of there. But we don't want to do that, because then that means, oh, that means I wasted, you know, $10,000, so I'm going to keep on putting money in, because maybe something will change. But what did, I think it was Einstein or somebody said, the definition of insanity is keep on doing the same thing and expect a different result. That's exactly it. So I could not make the right decision till I acknowledged I had made the wrong decision. Until I honestly admitted to myself that I was going the wrong way, I could not take the corrective action to go the right way. That's exactly the way life is. Be honest with yourself. Admit there are things that aren't going right, whether it is in a relationship, whether it's in terms of personality, anger management, whatever it might be. We're not talking about making a public confession to somebody. We're talking about privately, just to be honest with yourself. And that is the first step to freedom, and that is symbolized by the maror. Cognitively understanding what it is I need to correct. Okay. Now, the second food is matzah. Of course, I'll address the question. We eat matzah before we eat more, but I'm going to address matzah second, then I'll go back and explain why this, the order in the Seder was different. Now, we know, what's the story with matzah? That the Jews wanted to bake bread for the trip, and in order to bake bread, you have to let the dough rise for a few moments, which is chametz. But the Egyptians were in such a rush to get us out of there that we didn't even have time to let our bread rise. We had to bake it in the oven as soon as the flour was mixed with the water, and to commemorate the idea that we left Egypt in such a hurry that we didn't have time to let our dough rise, that is why we have to eat matzah on Pesach. Now, for most of Pesach, you don't have to eat matzah, you just are not allowed to eat the bread, but the Seder night, you absolutely must, right? It's a mitzvah d'oraisa. That's why it's special matzah, right? Like, you know, the Seder matzah is not just kosher l'Pesach in the sense of not being chametz, but it was actually made for the purpose of the mitzvah. That's called shemura matzah. You have to have, for the Seder, you have to have shemura matzah. Now, some people are machmir, that they have shemura matzah for all 7 or 8 days of Pesach, every single meal. But that's pretty expensive, especially if you have a large family. But at a minimum, you must have shemura matzah in Israel for the Seder, and in Chutz Laaretz for the two Seders, both Seders. Anyway, so matzah, now the difference between matzah and chametz is this though, a very, very interesting spiritual point that Maral points out. Chametz represents a lot of negative things. Chametz is puffed up, arrogance. Matzah is flat, humility. But another aspect of chametz and matzah is that chametz represents inertia. Because here's the thing, if you pour water on flour, even if you didn't pour, if flour comes in contact with water, and you do nothing for 18 minutes, you leave it alone for 18 minutes, it becomes chametz. You don't have to do anything to make it chametz. Chametz is what happens by itself. Matzah, to arrest the process of fermentation, to stop it, you need to take affirmative action of baking. So this is a very interesting perspective, that the difference between chametz and matzah is not only arrogance versus humility, which is one aspect, but rather chametz represents inertia and complacency. Matzah represents decisive action. And if you don't act in time, your matzah becomes chametz. Now, once you bake it, right, matzah does not become matzah cannot become chametz once it's baked. But until it's baked, you got to bake it very quickly. In fact, from the time the water hits the flour till the time that you have a finished matzah cracker must be less than 18 minutes, and typically it's around 12 minutes. That's why Ashkenazi matzah is so thin, because so they want to bake it very quickly. If 18 minutes passes and you don't have a baked matzah cracker, even if it's half baked or something, it is chametz, it got to be thrown away. In fact, that's why good matzah bakeries will stop production really every 18 minutes and clean the machine, because you're going to have some problems, because pieces of dough might get stuck and they did become chametz, and then they may make the other matzos treif because you're baking matzah in an oven that has fermented dough in it. Yeah.
Is there any gematria in relation to 18 in relation to?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Do you remember hearing a gematria?
No,
I don't remember it.
Chai
is life. That's right. That's a general. Yeah, I think that's a general gematria. So therefore, like this, if Mora represents the cognitive honesty that there's bitterness in my life, there's a mitzrayim, matzah represents the imperative of doing something about it. And this is really a different process, because there are people who have all sorts of insight into their problems, but they're not interested in taking action to correct them. Decisive action. You know, this may be the difference between psychoanalysis and behavioral therapy. You know, psychoanalysis is into, you know, Freud school is into identifying the source of all of your traumas and anxieties, going all the way back to childhood, to pre-birth traumas, you know, to preconception traumas, whatever that would be, going all the way back. And you can be in psychoanalysis for 50 years, and you understand every single experience you have ever been through, but you don't necessarily change. It's not enough to be aware. Awareness is necessary. But the lesson of matzah is taking action. And taking action is a very important idea, because when you take action, one mitzvah causes another mitzvah. It's like building a bridge. You know the way they build a bridge? It's very, very amazing. You want to span a certain distance over water. So initially, they may just put one wire across, and then they intertwine another wire, and then the two wires can support a heavier weight, and then eventually you can support a whole big bridge. That's one of the ways you start, but it starts with that first wire. You take a little bit of action, and this is very important, because all of us, in fact this may be something you think about on this trip, you know, you come to a place like Jerusalem, and I'm sure that you will have moments of great, great inspiration. And each person will have different inspiration. It might be at the Kotel, it might be Shabbat, it might be just walking around the streets and seeing all the Jews and the beautiful children and the like. All sorts of things. And inspiration is a wonderful thing. But you know, if you don't concretize inspiration with some type of action, the inspiration just dissipates and disappears. Emotions come and go unless they're concretized. There was a famous American academic, Robert Hutchins, who was kind of a boy wonder. He became president of the University of Chicago when he was like 22. I mean, he had many graduate students who were older than him. And he was a real, real genius, a brilliant person. But he was not taking care of himself physically, so somebody wants to ask him, you know, Dr. Hutchins, why don't you exercise? Why don't you run? Why don't you do something? So he said the following. He said, you know, every once in a while, I do get the urge to exercise. But when I do, I just lie down for a few moments. I know that the urge will pass. I don't let it bother me. This is what he said. And, you know, the same thing with a lot of things. Let's say, I don't know if any of you have had these experiences, but, you know, let's say, you know, you have a fight with somebody. There's somebody that you're not talking to because you're angry. You have a grudge, he has a grudge, and you haven't been talking. I think at your age it probably doesn't happen yet, but when you get older, unfortunately, these things tend to happen for one reason or another. And every once in a while, you just tell yourself, you know, this is stupid, this is crazy, I'm just going to pick up the phone and, you know, say, hey, let's be friends, let's go out for a beer, whatever it is. But, you know, if the phone is right next to you when you have that decision, maybe you'll do it. If you have to walk to the other end of the room, by that time it's already gone. Maybe tomorrow, you know. I'm not really ready. In other words, you're going to lose your courage. So, if the lesson of Maror is to be honest to yourself, the lesson of Matzah is the imperative of concrete action, not simply relying on insight, but to actually do action. Because again, Matzah represents action. because without action, it becomes chametz. Matzah does not happen by itself. With apologies for mentioning to a bunch of British something from the American Revolution, but Thomas Paine, who was one of the king's enemies, Thomas Paine once remarked that liberty requires eternal vigilance. You constantly have to guard it. By itself, it doesn't stay by itself. It dissipates. Spiritual growth requires vigilance. You can't just be on hold, right? As the Vilna Gaon said, if you're not consciously trying to go up, you go down. It's like an escalator. Did you ever try as a kid an up escalator? I'm sorry, trying to go up on a down escalator? Mm-hmm. So if you just stand still, you don't stand still, you go down. You got to consciously try to go up just to stay in place. That's what spiritual life is. And that's the lesson of matzah. Now, the last food is Pesach. And the Korban Pesach, we don't have today, unfortunately, because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. But we pray that we should have it again. And here, Pesach is a very interesting offering. It's a lamb that's eaten as a sacrifice. But the Torah says that you have to bring it with other people. Meaning to say, you bring it with your family. Or, if you don't have a family or you're by yourself, you have to join with the family. Even if you have a big appetite and it's a small lamb, you cannot bring the Korban Pesach by yourself. So Pesach teaches us that in our spiritual journeys, we need to link up with other people. We can't do it ourselves. We need friends. Now friends are not just utilitarian. On one level, yeah, I need a friend because if I lose my keys, you know, who do I call up, you know, if I need a ride? We'll call that a utilitarian need for friendship. And then there's a social need for friendship. You know, you want to hang out, you want to spend time. And all of that is important, and I'm not demeaning that. But the real idea of friendship are people who create spiritual fellowship in which each one helps the other to grow and become a better person. In marriage, that's also the ideal, that each one brings out the best in the other. And among people who are not married, that friendship exists as well. Now, you have to understand that type of friendship is not always going to be easy. If we're just hanging around for a good time, you know, I'm not here to improve you, you're not here to improve me, we're not here to work on things together, so we just have a good time. But when you really love somebody and care about them, sometimes you're going to point out things that they're not doing right. And they will point out things you're not doing right. But because it comes from love, it's not just to be critical or judgmental, but it comes from genuine love, the hope would be that each of us can receive that type of feedback and we can act upon it. That's the deepest type of friendship. A true friend doesn't let the other person go to pot. A true friend isn't indifferent when someone is not living up to the spiritual goodness that is within them. But that's a challenging friendship. That's a difficult friendship sometimes. But those are the most meaningful and significant relationships that we have. Again, that is the highest level of a marriage. But even short of marriage, we know we try to have friendships like that. Now, that doesn't mean everybody will. Some people will be your friends socially. Okay, now there's friends, you know, people you hang around with, people that just, you know, you can joke around with a little bit. But we need a few, maybe one, two, that are really that type of friendship. And we have to be a friend too. In other words, you want them to be a friend for me, I got to be a friend for them. That's the lesson of Pesach. So, you see the three symbols here. Moror, be honest to yourself in tasting the bitterness. Don't deny what you need to change. Matzah, when you have the insight, concretize it in action. And Pesach, find a community of people who are striving towards those same goals. Don't do it alone. Because alone, there's all sorts of temptations. You know, we're going to fail. We need chizuk. We need support. We need a support system in life. Now, one final question. If indeed mara represents identifying your problem and matzah is doing something about your problem, it would appear, would it not, that logically we should eat marar before matzah. And yet in the Seder, we actually eat matzah before we eat marar. So that seems to be reversing the...
But that's the way we accept the Torah.
Not in what way?
That's how we accept the Torah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm not following. Yeah, which way?
We will
deal with it and
we'll find out.
Right. So I'm going to say something very similar to that, just a little addition. That's a very good comparison. And that is the following. There is a danger with focusing on moror first. Because when I focus on my failures and my inadequacies, that can sometimes give me such depression and despair that I give up hope. So before I start digging into my dark recesses, I have to be convinced that I have the capacity to change. And therefore, when I know I have the capacity to change, then I'm ready to embark on that self-analysis. But unless I am convinced of that capacity, my self-analysis may actually be destructive. I may be opening up dark corners that will disable me. Okay, so these are just some thoughts to think about for Pesach, and I hope it'll be useful for you. And so when are you going back?
Tomorrow.
Wow. Well, anyway, I want to wish you all a Chag Kosher Sameach, and may Pesach truly be a time of liberation, both for us as people, for Am Yisrael, and really for the whole world.
Amen.
Thank you.